following is a recording of an open discussion Bible study given at Narrowgate Baptist Church in Miami, Florida.
Last week, we began our study with verses 1 through 17. In those verses, Paul presented his opening greeting, where he identified himself and affirmed his desire to come to Rome to see the saints in person. He also declared his apostolic mission as that of bringing about the obedience of faith among all the Gentiles for the Lord's name's sake, verse 5, meaning for his public recognition and glory. He started at the beginning with the promise that Abraham received from God that all the Gentile nations would be blessed by one of his future descendants. This promise was recorded in the writings of Moses and expanded upon by subsequent prophets in the Holy Scriptures. Paul makes it clear, through both human genealogy and divine pronouncement, that Jesus Christ is that promised descendant, verses 3 and 4. Then he makes some comments on the effects that this knowledge has upon all those who hear it and truly believe it. Now many hear it to be sure, and many say they believe it, just as the Jews had heard the commandments of God from Moses after they were brought out of Egypt. But not everybody who hears really believes, as the record of that situation and the subsequent events clearly demonstrates. Everywhere, from Old Testament to New, the Scriptures affirm that the effect of faith, the effect of believing God, is subsequent obedience to God, like Abraham demonstrated when he was willing to slaughter his own son on an altar as a sacrifice to God. You see, he was willing to obey God when it seemed impossible that God would ever even give him that command. But he believed God and he obeyed God. And Paul drove this home by his quote from the Old Testament, Habakkuk 2:4, that the righteous person will live by their faith. That is, they'll live in accordance to what they truly believe. In other words, if you really believe that God is and that he has commanded certain things, then you will do those things, at least to the very best of your ability. Paul makes this clear in the first 17 verses, where he's discussing the true believers. But then, in verse 18, he's going to begin to show the contrasting situation. He's been talking about believers. Now he's going to talk about unbelievers, the situation that exists among the unbelieving. He's going to go on with this contrasting view all the way through chapter 3, verse 20. In these verses, Paul is going to demonstrate that all unbelieving mankind, whether Jew or Gentile, is sinful and corrupted in the sight of God. And the effects of this unbelief, which the Scriptures declare is without excuse, will be examined in some detail. Paul's letter to the Romans is probably the most precisely detailed and logically presented treatise on systematic Christian theology as you can find anywhere. In the verses we'll be considering in this lesson, Paul lays out the progression of events that characterize the descent of a society or a nation into moral depravity and the consequences of that descent. It can be seen and readily identified by distinct and obvious signs. The consequences of the fall of man was the total loss of the spiritual life that Adam and Eve had at their creation. The result of this loss is that mankind no longer has any innate hunger and desire for holiness and righteousness. Therefore, God has to apply and continually maintain certain internal and external restraints to prevent mankind from a prompt self-destruction by his very own doings. God doesn't need to cause anything of his own to chasten a society. He can simply reduce or cease to do what he's already doing, namely, restraining man's innate human depravity. Internally, he provides a conscience that helps to curb our actions. And externally, he provides governments with laws and enforcement personnel for the protection of the weaker members of society. But mankind, if left alone, without a functioning conscience, and free of laws and effective enforcement of those laws, will, and always has in the past, degenerate into a violent and merciless mob. It's only because of God's ongoing mercy of maintaining these internal and external restraints that has allowed the human race to last as long as it has so far. But he has in the past, and still does now, either scale back or intensify that level of restraint according to the behavior of that nation or society. We all know full well that actions have consequences, and so it is with God. But, by the mercy of God, even the most godless and violent of societies usually have some small degree of restraint to prevent their total destruction. But one day, at the end of this age, he's going to remove these restraints, and we know what will happen. But in the meantime, God uses this restraining power to either bless or curse a nation or society by either strengthening or reducing his level of internal and external restraints. This is one of the primary means God uses to providentially steer his creation in the direction he has planned from before time began. As we said before, there is a definite order of progression, and there are causes and inevitable effects of those causes, and all of it can be readily seen and identified because God wants humanity to plainly see and understand both the benefits of righteousness and the consequences of evil. Now, I have titled this lesson, The Road to Perdition. The first section of verses I'm going to read are verses 18 through 20, and I have subtitled these verses, Step 1, Denial. Reading now from the text, starting at verse 18. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes, His eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they, meaning mankind, are without excuse. Romans 1, verses 18 through 20. If you think about it, everything that has happened in history, regardless of the magnitude and or duration, started with a single action. What happened in that initial action led to whatever happened next, and so on and so on. Now, there's infinite examples we could use, but just for one, the American Revolution. It started with a single shot, and no one to this day seems to actually know who fired it. But the course of history for this country, and dare I say even the free world, has been affected by that single event. And our lives to this very day are surely affected by the things that directly resulted from that initial action. In that particular situation, nobody was able to predict the outcome of events. So the whole thing started over a difference of principles and beliefs, over the innate desire of humanity to be free men, in direct opposition to an elite group that wished to maintain control over them. Now, there was no playbook for freedom for them to make reference to. But there was a book that speaks of righteousness and fairness to our fellow men, and treating others as we want them to treat us. And based on the teachings of this book, a new nation began to emerge after that single event. But on the other hand, there are many situations where the outcome is predictable. There are many situations where history and experience has demonstrated that certain actions that we take will produce predictable results. In the medical field, for example, doctors can observe initial symptoms and from them diagnose a problem and accurately predict the next stage of events that'll occur. Another for instance, I don't know how it works for others, but for myself, when I'm coming down with a cold, the first symptom is always a sore throat, then comes the stuffy nose, then the fever and achy feeling, and finally the heavy coughing. It takes about 2 weeks to run its course, and when I see the first symptom, I can predict the whole coming scenario with regrettable accuracy. Now, I've used these examples to make the point that although life isn't always predictable, nevertheless, there are many things that we can predict with very reliable accuracy because we have historically established and documented precedent, and we have our own experiences as well. Now, the simple truth is, however, that we can't all learn everything from our own experiences. We don't live long enough for that. So, we learn a great deal from what we're told by others, wise individuals who do have first-hand experience and direct knowledge. Now, with this, I can get to the point that I want to make. The Holy Scriptures are a compilation of divinely inspired writings that have been passed on to mankind for our instruction. They are not simply a group of very wise men recording their own thoughts and ideas for posterity, but rather a Holy Spirit-directed compilation of divine instructions and revelation. What they say is accurate and true and irreversible. If they give instructions regarding an issue, we are very wise to pay attention. And if they warn us of consequences of certain actions, we must not ignore those warnings, lest we suffer those consequences for sure and certain. What Paul is going to describe in these verses from 18 through 32 are the causes and resultant inescapable effects, the causes and resultant inescapable effects of certain actions and beliefs on the part of all humanity, all mankind, no matter who they are, no matter where they live. Remember, we said that verse 18 begins a contrasting comparison between the believers who live by their faith versus the unbelievers who live as Paul is going to describe in these next verses. Paul says that the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Notice that Paul says that the wrath of God is revealed not on those who don't know the truth, but on those who do, but then suppress it in unrighteousness. According to this verse, God's wrath is not revealed for ignorance of something, but rather for actually knowing it and then intentionally denying it because it opposes our own unrighteous desires. This is the root cause of everything that follows. This is the root cause of everything that follows. This is like that first shot on the old North Bridge at Lexington that led to the National Revolutionary War. All that follows starts right here. When God gave His Ten Commandments to Moses to take to the people, He began them with His declaration that He is God, and the people were to have no other gods besides Him. Exodus 20, verses 1 through 3. Everything else God says afterwards, issues forth from that initial understanding. That is God's shot heard round the world. Everything else whatsoever rests and builds on this divine declaration that He is God, and humanity will have none other besides Him. Paul commences his contrast with this declaration, that the wrath of God is made manifest upon those who fail at the primary level, the level of accepting the obvious fact that God exists. But lest someone protests, "But how do we know for sure?" Paul says the following words, quoting again, "Because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them." Do you understand? God says He has made His presence known to man, and He has personally made it evident to man by their intellect and their logic and their understanding. Continuing, "For since the creation of the world, His, God's, invisible attributes, His eternal power, and His divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made. The creation declares the glory of God," you see, so that they are without excuse. There is no excuse, "But how do we know there's God? If you have ears and eyes to see and hear, then you are without excuse." God says the eyes and ears and logic that He gave the human species is sufficient to make it absolutely, perfectly clear beyond excuse that God is, and that He is holy and perfect and eternal and all-powerful. His creation is sufficient to make all mankind guilty who deny Him. We often hear the protest that there's no way to be sure because God isn't visible to us. But that's no argument at all, because Jesus was visible to us in bodily form, and almost nobody believed Him, even when He did undeniable miracles. So the problem is not the invisibility of God. The problem is not the invisibility of God, nor the lack of credible evidence, but rather it is the words of God. It's what God says. It's what He says that causes men to deny Him, not His invisibility. It is what God says that causes men to deny Him. It is not His invisibility, and not a lack of irrefutable evidence. The creation declares Him. Paul says that whatever is knowable about God has been made evident to mankind by all the things that God has made. By this alone, mankind is seen by God as inexcusably obligated to accept God's existence. There can be no credible argument to the contrary. Thus says God. Example, when the complexities of the DNA that forms the building blocks of living creatures finally started to be understood, it was said by some that this was the end of Darwinian evolution theory, because the immense complexities of the building blocks of life made random mutation utterly impossible to defend. We know that science has over and over proven that the universe and all that's in it, especially living creatures, could not possibly have happened without an intelligent designer behind them. That's not possible. No mentally competent adult human being can actually believe that. And all emerging scientific evidence continues to support and reinforce that obvious conclusion. All emerging scientific evidence continues to support and reinforce that obvious conclusion that creation was designed by a designer. The entire universe seems to be held in its proper place by a delicate balance of inertia against gravitational attraction. And what is gravity anyway? Nobody knows. We've devised ways to measure its effect, but nobody can even explain it. It defies all logic. And the very same stem cells that form a heart in a newly conceived baby also form the liver and lungs and all the other parts. And how do these cells know what to make? How do they know what to do? And how do they know where to put all these parts? And how to tie them together so that they all function as a single functioning being? Look, we know it's absurd to think it all happens by random chance. Utterly more than absurd. There is immense complex information that's sent to the cells to make them do the things they do. And this complex information is passed on chemically and electrically in direct operation of the DNA coding sequences to conclude that it's all natural mutations is far beyond any rational defense. Paul says that the whole creation, with all its complexities, is God's visible proof of His invisible existence. It is how He has chosen to make Himself irrefutably evident to all humanity throughout the ages, even before we had the scientific learning to see and to begin to understand all the enormous complexities that are involved. Science has undeniably reinforced the existence of God. But what has actually happened with this explosion of science? Instead of accepting the obvious, unbelieving mankind simply denies the truth of that evidence and even argues that it means just the opposite of what it obviously does. We constantly hear that science disproves the existence of God. Now, how absurd is that? How absolutely absurd is that? It's like a stubborn man looking at a white piece of paper and swearing up and down that it's really black. You see, it isn't the evidence that's the problem. It's the absolute refusal to accept the obvious meaning of that evidence. The refusal to accept the obvious meaning of that evidence. There is none so blind as the one who simply refuses to see. And this is what Paul is saying, that those who deny God are not doing it out of ignorance, but out of a stubborn refusal to accept the irrefutable truth. And why do they so adamantly resist? Because they love their unrighteousness. They love their sinful lives and refuse to give it up, regardless of the preponderance of evidence or the resultant consequences that may come about. Some examples. This same week that I'm writing this lesson, I've heard two separate comments on secular TV programs that said, first comment, quoting, Well, there's no tangible evidence that God really exists, end quote. And the second one, quoting, I only believe what I can see with my own eyes, end quote. Do you see how absolutely insane this is? What, no tangible evidence? Who's this guy kidding? And the other statement, he only believes what he sees with his own eyes. What? Is he totally blind? Can he not see the creation? The heavens declare the glorious and miraculous works of God. And we see that all around us every minute of every day. And then we can say that there's no tangible evidence. And that we can't see anything that demonstrates God's existence. That's like the people who followed Jesus around, watched him heal the sick, cast out demons, raise the dead, calm the seas, feed people with out of nothing, and then declare, who is this guy? Duh! Who would he have to be to do those things? Who would he have to be to do those things? If you come home and find that your house is ransacked, and all of your valuable belongings are missing, you are quite certain that there was a burglar in your home. You didn't have to see him to believe he exists. The evidence speaks for itself. So again, I say, it is not the lack of evidence. It is the stubborn refusal to accept the irrefutable conclusions of that evidence by suppressing the truth. By suppressing the truth, Paul does not simply mean that they try to keep anybody from hearing about it, although that does certainly go on without a doubt. But the primary point that he's making is that they intentionally suppress the obvious meaning of that evidence. They twist it sideways and turn it backwards and upside down. They do all kinds of mental gymnastics to try to explain it away in their own minds so that they don't have to deal with the obvious consequences of it. They deny it and deny it until they themselves are able to believe any harebrained alternative that's offered, no matter how absurd it might be. For instance, natural evolution. Everybody knows better, it's absurd. Verse 20 is a formal indictment by God through the writing of Paul that all those who deny him are guilty of intentional suppression of known truth for the express intention of indulging their own unrighteousness. And he says that they are without excuse. Look, my dear secular friends, please don't think that you can plead ignorance at the judgment throne of God. He has openly and publicly declared that his creation of this universe, by itself alone, even absent of any further information or evidence whatsoever, is considered irrefutable proof of his existence. And unbelief in God, in the face of a universe of tangible and visible evidence, is inexcusable. And the consequences is everlasting damnation in the lake of eternal fire. So says the one and only living God in his holy scriptures. Do not be one of these, beloved. Now, to my dear Christian friends, do not be intimidated by an unbelieving secular society that calls black white and white black, that looks at scientific evidence and swears up and down that it proves exactly the opposite of what it obviously does. God has given mankind a rational and logical mind, with which We are to draw sensible conclusions from available information. The information is right there before our eyes. We need only observe and use our God-given faculties of reason to conclude that someone made all of this happen. It is a product of an intelligent designer. There is no other conclusion that can reasonably be drawn from the available evidence. Any conclusion to the contrary is not based on the evidence, but on something other than the evidence. And the Scriptures clearly tell us what that is. It is mankind's innate desire to practice many things that God has forbidden. So, to soothe our conscience and ease our fears, we concoct alternative conclusions that the evidence clearly refutes. And just like the stubborn man who swears the white paper is really black, unbelieving mankind stubbornly swears that the evidence actually means the opposite of what it obviously does. This is why I have always said that public debates with secular society are for the most part futile. Many dear Christians think that if we can just present the evidence clear enough, or if we could just perform some miracle, that secular society would accept the truth and come to faith. But ask yourself, how did that work for Jesus? What many Christians don't understand or don't want to believe is that secular society already has the evidence presented more perfectly than any human being can ever present it. Verse 19, the creation of God declares His glory. But they intentionally suppress the obvious conclusions because they want to. They don't need more or better evidence. They need a new heart that will rightly respond to the clear and perfect evidence that they already have. This we can't give them because it is a gift of God, reserved for those whom He has chosen to receive His gift of perfect love. Faith is not merely coming to the right conclusion or making a right decision, although it surely does involve both. It surely does involve both. But faith is a fundamental change of heart and mind that affords the missing human capacity to derive the right conclusion and to make the right decision. Secular mankind will intentionally suppress, deny, and question the obvious facts to accommodate their personal affections and desires for sin and lust. But because the evidence is so clear and so irrefutable, God says, quoting, that they are without excuse, end quote. Now, what exactly does God mean by they are without excuse? Well, essentially, that they will be held fully accountable for their intentional suppression of the truth of God's eternal power and divine nature, verse 20. They deny His existence and eternal power because they dislike His divine nature. They deny His existence and power because they dislike His divine nature, not because they don't have acceptable evidence to the contrary. God is holy and righteous, and mankind is neither of these. And moreover, He doesn't want to be. The Holy Scriptures do not attribute the denial of God to ignorance. The Holy Scriptures do not attribute the denial of God to ignorance, but to a stubborn refusal to repent of sins. Almost everyone is familiar with the quote from Jesus recorded in John 3:16 regarding God sending His only beloved Son into the world as a Savior to all those who would believe in Him. But very few, I perceive, could quote the next sentence out of Christ's mouth immediately after those words that He said. And what did He say immediately following that? Quoting now, "He who believes in Him is not judged. He who does not believe has been judged already, because he has not believed in the name of the only begotten Son of God." Listen now, this is the judgment. This is the judgment, that the light has come into the world, and men loved the darkness rather than the light, because their deeds were evil. The light has come into the world, and men loved the darkness rather than the light. Why? Because their deeds were evil. John 3:18 and 19. To be perfectly clear, the term light, as it's used in this sentence, is a metaphor for truth. And darkness represents suppressed truth and denial of that truth because of a predisposition to evil deeds. Humanity loves to sin, and they will suppress anything and everything they need to justify their continued practicing of it. Mankind loves darkness rather than light because their deeds are evil. Their innate desires are for unrighteousness. Now, I've spent a lot of time on this point because everything that comes after this rests firmly upon this. As we made reference to earlier, every journey, no matter how long, starts with the first step. And every string of consequences has a first cause that started it all, like pushing the first domino in a row of dominoes. The road to perdition. The road to perdition has a first step. The road to perdition has a first step, a first cause, from which every other consequence eventually proceeds forth. And the Holy Scriptures tell mankind what that first step is. That first cause is not believing God. Not believing God. The initial fall of mankind in the Garden of Eden and all the subsequent consequences on humanity was not because Adam and Eve didn't believe that God existed, but that they didn't believe what He said about eating from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. They didn't believe what He said was going to happen. They apparently didn't really believe that they would truly die. Of course, we know that Satan had a hand in that decision. But in the end, it finally came down to whether they really believed what God said or they did not. That's what it finally came down to. The resultant effects of that decision to disobey God had both immediate and long-term consequences for Adam and Eve, and eventually for every human who would ever come after them. Sin entered the world. Sin entered the world by a single first cause event, an act of disobedience, resulting from not believing what God had said. Sin entered into the world by an act that demonstrated disbelief in what God had said. Obviously, God takes His Word very, very seriously. Deadly serious even, beloved. And there are inescapable consequences of our actions, whether we want to believe it or not. Once we take that first step in the wrong direction, then the path we're on has its own progressive pattern of events and characteristics, just like links in a chain, each one building upon the previous. The next verses continue to explain the sequential signs of being on that wrong road, the road to perdition. Now, in the next verses, I've labeled this step two, subtitled Substitution. Substitution. Quoting now, verse 21 through 23. For even though they knew God, they did not honor Him as God or give Him thanks, but they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools. Professing to be wise, they became fools. And exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man and birds and animals and crawling creatures. Romans 1, verses 21 to 23. Paul begins his explanation of step 2 with a brief summation of step 1. He says, quoting, "For even though they knew God, they did not honor Him as God or give Him thanks," end quote. You see, there's no such thing as not believing that God is. There's no such thing as not believing that God is. The glory of creation, with its incomprehensible complexities of perfect balances and interactions, makes God's existence a total foregone conclusion, a no-brainer in today's vernacular. God's declaration is that He has provided much more visible evidence than is necessary to establish His existence and His eternal power and glory to these pitiful little creatures called human beings. With this firmly established, Paul says that even though they knew God, they refused to honor Him as God or even give Him thanks for His incredible creation and their own existence. But, of course, this denial of God leaves an enormous void that can't be ignored, because we humans were created with an understanding of logic. We are aware that all of this stuff we see around us had to come from somewhere, and if it was not created by someone of immense intellect and power, then where did it all come from? There's no escaping that question. And now, Paul is going to tell us, long before it happens, that stubborn mankind will devise a whole host of absurd speculations and harebrained theories to try to fill that infinite void left by the denial of what they know to be true, but insist on suppressing. That only a wise and powerful and living God could have made this whole thing that we call creation. There are no other viable alternatives. But a stubborn, sin-loving mankind will not accept that conclusion, regardless of the fact that it's both logically and scientifically irrefutable. So, if it is irrefutable, then why does man still try to refute it? That's the real question, isn't it? And it really has a very simple answer. If it were somehow possible, listen to me now, if it were somehow possible to completely detach and strip away and remove all of the obvious moral implications of creation by an intelligent designer, and be able to simply form a conclusion from the scientific and logical facts, there would be absolutely no evolutionists in existence. Do you understand me? If it were possible to extricate morality from the scientific evidence, there would be no one who claims they believe that the scientific evidence supports Darwinian evolution. It does not. Everybody knows it does not. But here's the problem. We cannot strip the two. They are inextricably linked together. And even though the evidence itself is irrefutable, it's the moral implications of accepting that evidence that produces the endless array of futile speculations to the contrary. It's the moral implications of accepting that evidence that produces the endless array of futile speculations to the contrary. It would be humorous if it wasn't so tragic. I am absolutely certain that mankind would swear they believed that the tooth fairy created the universe before they accepted that God created it, because the tooth fairy imposes no moral restrictions on their behaviors. And in fact, the tooth fairy is probably a much more credible possibility than random mutations of cells and unaided natural evolution. Pardon my humor. The point of this is that when man decides to intentionally suppress the obvious truth, then he realizes that he must offer some kind of alternative, because the question does not go away. So therefore, men with credentials and titles concoct alternatives to God that an eagerly awaiting public is desperately looking for. Some way to appease the fears of God's ultimate wrath that they know accompanies their intentional suppression of the truth that's inside of them. So, when they get an alternative that offers them some relief, they grab onto it and hold on for dear life. They'll tenaciously defend their foolish theories, not so much because they really believe them, but because their hopes of avoiding the wrath of God rests upon these theories. To concede the error and even the obvious absurdity of their theories is to accept their inevitable fate. And that's precisely what they will never, never, never do. The alternatives include many and diverse fictitious gods also. Many people who realize the untenable nature of natural evolution create their own gods instead. But these man-made gods don't hold mankind to the same standards of morality as the true God. So in their minds, they get the best of both worlds. They get a God or gods that explain their creation, but at the same time leave them free of the moral restraints of the true, real, living God. This is simply another form of the same suppression of the truth. But the fact is, the false gods of man's making are often more violent and perverse than the people who concocted those gods. Sometimes these alternative gods arise out of pure superstition and native culture. But other times they are devised by men of professed higher learning and based on scientific evidence, which they twist to meet their preconceived intentions. Paul says, quote, "They become futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened." They became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Here we start to see some effects of intentional suppression of the truth, in that it results in man's heart becoming darkened to the truth that they have received from God. They repeat the lie so often that they almost come to believe it themselves. Or maybe they actually can convince themselves that it's actually true. A darkened heart is one that cannot rightly analyze the information available and come to a right conclusion because their own innate prejudices contaminate the data. They contaminate the analytical process. So to them, their faulty conclusions can seem to make sense when they're filtered through their own darkened and foolish hearts. When the suppression of known truth progresses to this point, and the heart is darkened, and the mind has become foolish, the natural progressions of events is to concoct alternatives, to make an exchange, to intentionally exchange the glory of an incorruptible and holy God for something else that isn't so demanding and intimidating. In light of the situation, this is a perfectly logical progression. Where we create a gaping hole in our lives, we look for something with which to fill it up. And this leads to the endless array of false gods and imaginary deities and bizarre idols and theories that fills the whole world to this very day, all made by mankind to fill the hole that's left by intentionally suppressing the known truth about God. All of this that we've discussed so far, man has done to himself, by himself, of his own choosing, because he refuses to honor God and give him thanks for their lives. These are the root causes for everything that Paul is going to describe next in his epistle. Which things are God's reaction to these root causes? Man produces the causes. God eventually reacts to those causes. There are godly orchestrated consequences to intentionally suppressing the known truth about God. It cannot go on forever. Some of those consequences are reserved for the future, but some of them are made for the immediate present. And Paul is going to give us a description of the immediate telltale signs that a society is suffering from the godly orchestrated consequences of denying the true God, refusing to give him thanks, and exchanging his glory for man-made substitutes. We'll begin this next week at verse 24, We'll call it step 3, consequences. But that's for next week. For conclusion now, let me say this. If and when we see that the godly orchestrated consequences are already happening, we know that the cause has been seen by God and the resultant effects are already underway. In our next verses, which we'll be examining next week, we'll be looking at those consequences in detail. And by them, we'll be able to assess the situation of our nation and our society and this whole planet. Is it possible that our nation is already on that fateful road to perdition? Join us again next week. In the meantime, to Him be the glory forever. Amen.
We hope you've enjoyed this study and found it informative. For additional studies and other materials, you can reach us at www.narrowgatebaptistchurch.com. Thank you for listening.